One of the ways that we cope as humans is denial. You know that whole thing about ostriches hiding their head in the sand? Like, we basically have our own ways of doing that. They're usually not quite that material. But sometimes they're pretty material. It's part of how we manage day by day. And two sort of obvious iterations of that are, I just don't think about that, and distraction. Distractions under our current cultural conditions in this part of the world are readily available. They're highly refined. They're also very profitable. And in the short term, at least, they can feel pretty great. And frankly, sometimes we need them. And so they're not going away anytime soon. Denial, which is the short word for I just don't think about it, denial, I think, is getting harder and harder to sustain, especially when it comes to some of the big themes that we all have to live with. For example, we've just been through a few weeks of the news cycle being heavily occupied with the Glasgow Climate Change Conference. I mean, again, this morning, now there's a document and all of the pundits weighing in on the wording. That's a global consideration of a big theme that we all have to live with, which is the state of the global climate, of the physical environment in which we all live, move, and have our being, and together with which we are sustained. And there are many things about that conference that might be interesting to consider, but in the context of what I want to explore today, there's at least one that might not come up that often. There is a third way that we often deal with things that we don't want to face, and that's by handing them off to experts or to leaders. We live in a pretty niched, pretty specialized culture in general. We have sort of an expert for everything. And that can be pretty wonderful to have that kind of resourcing. It can also contribute to us not engaging in certain ways that might not be that helpful. When we do hand things off to an expert or to a leader, what is it that we hope will happen when we do that? Well, among other things, I expect that many of us hope that the experts will help us make sense of things that are complex, that they'll put in the years of education and examination and deliberation, and they'll do that so they can bring us distilled information, so they can bring us data that will help us plug things that are too big for us to comprehend or apprehend into frameworks that are meaningful in our everyday lives. We need some help, and we're hoping for that help. In other words, we hope that the experts are going to help us understand what both the information and our lived experiences mean. And leaders, we want them to lead, right? That's why, if we're from a democracy, at least we elected them. And it's why we hand over our tax dollars and, in varying degrees, our trust. It's why we watch the news from a global climate conference to see if our leaders are stepping up, to see what the front edge of policymaking sounds like on a matter that's essential to our survival as a species. What are the leaders up to? At a previous iteration of this conference, this global conference on climate in 2014, Leonardo DiCaprio was invited to address the delegates, not just by virtue of being famous, also an activist. In any case, here's part of what he had to say. As an actor, I pretend for a living. I play fictitious characters, often solving fictitious problems. I believe humankind has looked at climate change in that same way, as if it were a fiction happening to someone else's planet, as if pretending that change wasn't real would somehow make it go away. But I think we know better than that. Every week we're seeing new and undeniable climate events, evidence that accelerated climate change is here now. Honored delegates, leaders of the world, I pretend for a living, but you do not. I haven't examined the whole text of what DiCaprio had to say, so maybe he covered this, but when I read that quote, it felt like the undercurrent in the quote is something along the lines of, somebody in this story needs to stop playing make-believe, to stop consuming distractions, presumably including his own movies, at such a rate that consumption overwhelms contemplation, to stop denying what we can all see is happening and to take some much-needed action. When we find ourselves facing things that feel too big for us to get a thorough handle on, even if we want to, where do we turn to find ways to engage? What do we look to for entry points in the task of meaning making, that fundamental human task of turning what we're experiencing into tellable, rememberable stories that can guide us in our everyday interactions and choices. How do we engage with that? Well, one of the things that we turn to is information, in our culture at least, and in particular, the kind of information that we often call data. We might all be getting just a little bit weary of hearing about the data these days. As a kind of thing that beleaguered public figures are constantly referencing and making complicated policy decisions, and understandably, and also sometimes in ways that feel like an honest grasping for facts in a world full of unknowns and rapid change, and sometimes, frankly, in ways that feel more like an attempt to hand off responsibility when personally bearing the weight of all those unknowns can get to be a bit too much. Yeah. There's a lot of jobs right now that I wouldn't want to have. But in a wider field of view, a basic philosophical definition of data is simply things known or assumed as facts, making the basis of reasoning or calculation. That's not a hard science definition, that's a philosophy definition. So as an idea, that's what data is. Now, that second part of what we're exploring, the meaning-making part, on what do we base our reasoning? On what do we base our thinking? Because it's on that basis that we often form our beliefs. And what we truly believe is what we practically express in what we do. It's how we live our lives. But data isn't the only way we form beliefs, is it? We may trust data, and perhaps especially what is often called empirical data, which is information originating in or based on observation or experience. But generally speaking, when we interact with the material world, we're often trusting what we don't see and can't know. Most of us, what we think of as solid, it's mostly empty space. We sit out on chairs for the most part without any conscious consideration of whether they'll hold us up or not. Perhaps we could call that kind of action faith. Does sitting on a chair seem like too ordinary an action to be called faith? It might depend on how we're used to hearing the word used. If we look it up, we find that there are two standard definitions for the word faith. The first is complete trust or confidence in someone or something. Not a big reach to see how that fits with the chair, right? So that might be a kind of faith, right? The second definition is strong belief in God or in the doctrines of a religion, and this is the juicy bit, based on spiritual apprehension rather than proof. Now that's a pretty interesting pair of definitions, especially considering that even a quick pass through the history of science, and no, we will not do that today, makes it relatively easy to see that it was when trusting what was observable, testable, or measurable, when that began to form the basis for modern science and the basis for what the culture generally regarded as trustworthy, sometime in the early to mid-1500s, when that started to happen, generally in European culture, that's when the notion that faith and science were at odds with one another started to get more traction. Partly that divergence, that presumed enmity, might be reasonably explained as the church feeling its cultural authority being threatened. When a religion has been cozy with power for hundreds of years and it starts to feel that grip slipping, things can get very nasty very quickly. Empirical evidence be damned, we can still lock you up and we can pronounce your soul in danger if you insist that our precious understanding of the cosmos and our place in it is incorrect, a one-sentence summary of the story of Galileo. Those days when religion got to tell the state what to do, are long gone. And if we were ever wondering if that was the case, all we need to do is just a quick Google search of any articles from the past year about churches' attempt to dictate public policy based on beliefs grounded in spiritual apprehension rather than proof. That is not happening. And one of the main reasons those days are in the past is because science and religion, in this part of the world, the Christian religion in particular, at least in some quarters, are starting to realize that they share the terrain in which their exploration is taking place. The realm we might call mystery, the realm where science and faith intersect. To have religious texts offer a definitive explanation for how the world came to be, how it functions, how it will end, that works when we are willing to pit a literal reading of a collection of ancient texts against data and to have our belief system affirm that when we are engaging in that sort of pitting against, we are engaged in a winner-takes-all contest. In that kind of a framework, for example, if archaeologists uncover an 11,000-year-old building in Jericho, which they've done, that discovery calls into question the biblical claim that Joshua destroyed all of Jericho. Not to mention the fact that a literal reading of that same collection of texts suggests that the world itself was created 5,000 years after the building in question was built. Historically, both religious traditionalists and atheists have claimed that in such an instance, we must choose between science or faith. But more and more of us are less and less interested in such a contest, less and less interested in trying to defend or live within such a framework. In fact, for many of us, the working assumption that one must either choose science or faith as the basis for belief gestures toward a serious problem that goes well beyond political debate. And we could call that problem the tangible threats of human ignorance. We're talking about existential threats. We're talking about the downside of not taking science seriously being the future of our species. And that's both serious and, as is becoming increasingly clear, urgent. So, and this is a very sort of stage four kind of question. How might we live generously, productively, and even joyfully at this intersection of faith and science? Well, as is often the case, stop one in exploring that kind of question is to consider that if door number one is trusting science, and door number two is trusting God, and we've been taught that we can't go through both doors at the same time, then perhaps there is a door number three. But to entertain that possibility, one of the first things we need to release our grip on is the binary of the door number one, door number two, our grip on either or thinking. In the stage schema that we've been referencing, that would be a very stage one point of view, that either or, right and wrong kind of point of view. An intriguing part of this is that it's never been easier to find reinforcement for ideological ignorance. And it's never been harder to tell where that reinforcement is actually sourced. And that's kind of the perfect situation if what we want is simply to take a position and find some other folks that believe something similar. It's just, that is now dead easy to do. But to look for the third way on this issue and on many others means that our starting assumption is not who is right. Our starting assumption is something more like who is exploring with integrity. And entertaining that question means, among other things, that I need to have a third definition of faith, which is something we've already explored in this series. If we accept that faith is limited by those two standard historic definitions that we considered a few moments ago, the definition of complete trust or confidence in someone or something, or strong belief in God or the doctrines of a religion based on spiritual apprehension rather than proof, if we stay stuck with those two definitions, then this exploration is actually over before it really even gets underway. But if we work with a definition of faith more like the one we've been considering throughout this series, that faith is exploring what we don't fully know or understand, we can start to see right away that science and faith have something absolutely central and deeply intriguing in common. Both modern science and lively faith have as their core commitment discovery. I've done this so many times, I don't want to bore you. Faith and religion are not synonyms. Okay? They often overlap, but they are different things. And so just to be clear, because what religion does is organize belief. That's very different than leaning into what you don't know. So just to be clear. So both modern science and lively faith have as their core commitment discovery. And by that, I mean both are committed to being proved wrong. And what I mean by that is that both modern science and lively faith are committed to moving beyond their previous best notions of whatever is being explored. Both believe that when we lean into what we don't know, we are leaning into something infinite. We are leaning into something, to use maybe a more scientific word for it, we're leaning into something expanding, not something contracting. If something is always expanding, that would be infinite. Just to close the circle on that idea. What religion often calls God is what science often calls reality. And either way, going deeper into that mystery is predicated on putting whatever we thought before up for grabs over and over and over again. It's entering our explorations with a beginner's mind, with our "I don't know, but I'm open to learn" on full alert. And that is utterly different from "I already know what I believe and I'm looking for evidence to support my position." It doesn't mean we ignore the evidence. We test things. That's how we make discoveries. But we test them so we will lean further into what we don't know, not so we can cement what we do and stop there. That's the common ground. It's also, in both realms, quite possibly a spiritual pursuit. I don't know if you've ever thought about science as a spiritual pursuit before. What I mean by that is that honest, integral exploration of what we don't know or understand will often take us into the realm of things outside of ourselves, beyond us. And that is the realm for which we might use the language of spirit or spiritual. Science and faith both function in that space. I ran across an interesting story recently. I wouldn't be surprised if this is familiar to some of you, but it wasn't to me. It's the story of a woman named Nancy Ellen Abrams. She's the author of a book called A God That Could Be Real: Spirituality, Science, and the Future of Our Planet. And this is how the first paragraph of one review describes Abrams and her story. "Many people are fed up with the way traditional religion alienates them. Too easily, it can perpetuate conflict, vilify science, and undermine reason. Nancy Abrams, a philosopher of science, lawyer, and lifelong atheist, is among them. And yet, when she turned to the recovery community to face a personal struggle, she found that imagining a higher power gave her a new freedom. Intellectually, this was quite surprising." That last sentence makes me chuckle every time, and I'm not exactly sure why. Anyway, it's that whole, how about that? So the backstory, to some degree, is that Abrams was dealing with a severe eating disorder and ended up in what was essentially a 12-step program, part of which, if you're familiar with 12-step programs, included turning to a higher power, whatever that means to the participant. And Abrams was, at this point in her life, almost an archetypal example of that science or faith binary. She's a very smart, deeply educated, rigorously scientific person, and she is surrounded by that scientific discourse. She's married to the famous astrophysicist Joel Primack and was in the middle at this point in her journey of helping him create a new theory of the universe based on dark matter and dark energy. She was in the midst of collaborating with him on two books that put that relatively new science into a social and political context. So that's kind of what's going on in her life. And in the middle of that, she finds herself wondering if there could actually be anything in this strange new universe that is worthy of being called God. And then, in the middle of all of that, her recovery program points her toward interacting with her higher power. It's kind of interesting to read her talking about this. She talks about doing it just because she was supposed to. I mean, she's working the program, right? And feeling a bit stupid about it, like she was talking to herself. Her universe did not include higher power, you know? That just wasn't a thing. And in the book, she talks about how she persists, and she surprises herself when, despite her revelations, or reservations rather, it works. And she is able to control her urges to eat. But it only works when she thinks of her conversational partner as something outside of herself, not just as one aspect of herself. And so she wonders why this works the way it does. And in true scientist fashion, she starts to study and investigate, one result of which is this book. And in the book, Abrams spends some time explaining why the traditional view of God as an independent, self-aware, cosmos-creating, all-powerful consciousness is not possible within the real universe as science currently understands it. She argues that that God was acceptable when our understanding of the universe was more limited, but our knowledge has changed, and so must our view of God. And then she goes on to suggest that in her theory, God is an emergent phenomenon of human activity. Emergent phenomenon is a fascinating idea. The examples she cites are things like the global economy, an emergent phenomenon of the actions of individual buyers and sellers, or the way that an ant colony made up of, you know, sort of mindless insects functions together somehow to make a colony that does remarkably complex things. The whole, she argues, on that basis of that theory, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Now, we might not end up where Abrams does, which is with the theory that God is an emergent reality. But in the context of her explorations, she makes what I think is a very salient, motivating observation about this intersection of faith and science. And I would say she's making this argument about the intersection of the lived experience of anyone who is actively exploring what they believe, as opposed to looking for evidence to cement what they already decided they believe. So anybody who's leaning in to what they don't know and understand fully. She unpacks her theory and what this view of God means for spirituality and our sense of our role in the universe, and she ties this in with our duty to take care of planet Earth for ourselves and for all future earthly lives. Several times in the book, Abrams says, "We are living in a critical era where our actions in this century will decide the fate of humanity, and if we don't get our concept of God right, we spend our time arguing and even engaging in violence over different views of God, we may make the wrong choices." She links those things to one another. Under the current cultural circumstances, that doesn't even sound like a novel idea to me. The foreword of the book, by the way, is written by Desmond Tutu. And in the foreword, one of the things that he says is, this is going to be hard for traditionalists to swallow. This is not going to work for everybody. And he kind of expands on that. Some critics have suggested that although her theory is interesting, it kind of lacks the narrative and mythical oomph that is necessary for a new concept of God to take on the existing traditions. It is worth remembering, if you are a person who thinks of themselves as exploring what they believe, that whatever you and I are exploring didn't always exist. Like whatever belief it is that we're pressing into, it started somewhere. It did this exact thing. Somebody came up with an idea, and then what? Why did some ideas about what we don't fully know and understand get the traction that they have and others not? If you're familiar with the Hebrew story, with the circumstances politically, geographically, culturally that the Jews were in when Jesus kind of was walking around in Palestine saying wise things, hold that story in your head for a second while we do this last bit. So critics have sort of said, nice theory, Abrams, you know, but it just doesn't have the as a mythos to become a new, widely held way of viewing life, the universe, and everything. I'm going to read her response to that, and I'm going to let her word on that be the last word of this exploration for today and just something to take away and think about. All right, so this is how she answers that question. She says, "People often ask me, do you seriously expect this idea of God to change the world? What about all the fanatics and terrorists?" So with that longer story about where the Judeo-Christian tradition comes from in mind, listen to how she answers that. "All I can say is that the only thing that changes the world is an idea that lights our fire at a moment when we are surrounded by dry, dead kindling. Today is that kind of time. Spiritual transformation does not require a majority vote. It doesn't matter if most people don't get it. All it takes is a committed minority, because the committed lead culture. The new scientific picture of the universe is a modern revelation. For many, the realization that God can be real and is emerging from human aspirations will also be a revelation. That these revelations are both happening now at so pivotal a moment in our species is truly grace. They have helped me move into the new universe and feel blessed and awestruck every day, as though I've moved from a dark basement apartment into a mountain area with a 100-mile view in all directions. I don't expect millions of people to change their ideas of God overnight, but to those who care about the human future and can see beyond ideology, to those who believe that truth matters, and to those who recognize the potential of humanity but don't see how to make us rise to that potential, it could make all the difference to discover a God that is real. I'm going to leave it there, and we'll keep exploring what we believe.